Let your yes be yes and your no be no. I'm going to come back to that. Well, good morning. Can you think of the biggest decision that you have ever been part of? The biggest decision you have been part of. Have you made a decision with others that will determine things for years, even years after you died, the lives of your children? Have you been part of a decision like that? I think of a family or even a couple deciding to emigrate, but not in the age of jet travel. It's too easy. Emigrate when it meant 6 months in a leaky boat. And that's a big decision. The future will be forever different. The recent referendums in Scotland and the United Kingdom are perhaps examples of big decisions in a generation that will ring through generations. I can't think of other examples. And they illustrate that the more people you have involved in a big decision, the harder it becomes to have a clean outcome. You probably agree that those referendums didn't really result in a good outcome. Not in terms of what they decided, but as a decision of a people. So what we're used to, more in the West at least, is everyone deciding for themselves as individuals. So when we have to make a group decision, we have all these individuals who decide what they think, and then they throw their word or their vote, yes or no, into a box, and it's all counted. But we know that, gosh, when you have a process like that, there are a whole lot of people always who, for one reason or another, don't take part, and there are people who think the issue isn't worth their voting, and you get a low result, and the validity is a bit uncertain. Many important issues run the risk of that happening. Unless everyone buys in and everyone agrees, the welfare of the whole can be at risk. Our first reading today from the book of Deuteronomy, the one that Harmon brought us, is set in a moment of national decision like this. People, we need to make a decision. And it comes after 40 years of Moses being the leader. It's not about who's going to be the leader. It's about whether the covenant that their parents made with the Lord was going to be affirmed in their generation. And as they stood at the edge of the wilderness with the land of promise before them, were they going to step into this land wholeheartedly endorsing the covenant with the Lord? Big decision. And they've been working up to this for 40 years, and Moses was talking them through it at this moment. And the map sort of, if you can see it, captures physically where they were on the plains of Moab. So, those who had left Egypt, that generation had died. And a new generation had grown up that did not remember slavery and only knew Moses and Joshua. And they lived their whole life, not as slaves, but as the children of freed slaves who lived now as nomads. They'd been wandering. Every now and then they'd pick up their tents and their structures and they'd move on to someplace. But they were now, as I said before, on the verge of this place that was their promised homeland. This is where they were going to build with stone. This is where they were going to plow fields. This is where they were going to be a people with a land, not just wandering nomads. And so that big change of context, that big moment of transition, comes the question to you as a people. Are you going to affirm the covenant with the Lord? Yes or no? I stood close by there in September, so the geography is very clear in my mind. But as Moses looked across the Jordan Valley, and as he's preparing to send the generation on, because he's not going. After this, he climbs Mount Nebo, and he's not seen anymore. He's handing over leadership to a new generation, to Joshua, but he has to take them through this point of decision. Are you staying with the Lord or not? And it happens in a remarkable way. He doesn't just call together the chiefs or the senior people. This is a holy democracy. It's men, women, children, servants, resident aliens, the people. All of you. Because all of you must be in this. We can't just have the prominence or the elites deciding on this. And it was about renewing the first edition of the covenant made 40 years before with their parents and their grandparents. And if you've got your Bible, it's in Exodus chapter 20. We're not going to spend a lot of time on it, but that's where it is. The first expression of this covenant. 40 years later, he comes back to it. And that first one, of course, had been made after they were rescued from Pharaoh and his chariots. It was made at Mount Sinai. Now, the terms of that covenant, because it is a legal document, framed as a legal document, the terms of that covenant with the Lord were delivered in simple imperative diktat. You shall. You shall not. And the reason for that is that Yahweh had just rescued this people, and he now owned them. They were his people. And he was defining the terms of the relationship and how this new freedom was going to be lived. And he had the right to do that. So if you're in Exodus 20, the first few words of those 10 words, as scholars refer to them, give you the flavor. And the Lord God spoke all these words, saying, I am the Lord your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. You shall have no other gods before me. Full stop. You shall not make for yourself a carved image or any likeness of anything that is in heaven above or that is in the earth beneath or that is in the water underneath. Full spot. Full stop. And there are 8 more. So that is what had been in place for 40 years. And the generation that had at that time said yes, well, they'd wobbled, to put it mildly. They hadn't managed to be faithful to that covenant. And there'd been some terrible situations where they had departed already from those first two commands there. Meanwhile, the Lord had been faithful. He'd stuck with this people. And he'd said to them, well, this first generation, not going to happen. I'll wait for the second. And that brings us up to this moment. So, on this day, after going through many things, the people of Israel stand on the edge of the great wilderness, on the plains of Moab, in sight of the promised land. And that's a view from Mount Nebo, looking down onto those plains and across. And you might just catch a little bit on the far left is the Dead Sea. And if your eyesight is really good, 27 kilometers across the valley is Jericho. It's all there. You can see it. Now, people, you see this. Can we make a decision? What's it going to be? This is what your whole life has been leading to. So the thing I want us to grasp here, if you haven't caught it already, is that what's being asked for is a total, collected, full-hearted commitment. In our elections, if someone gets the largest portion of the votes, we think, well, that's good enough. If they get over 60, that's a landslide, isn't it? Anything above that, it's rigged. But that's not how this is working. No, people, every one of you, man, woman, child, slave, free, whatever your economic or social condition is, you're all in this. You're part of the people. And it's going to be binding on you, your children, your children's children. Huge decision, isn't it? So that's why I asked at the outset, what's the biggest decision you've been part of? Are you going to affirm the covenant the Lord has made with your ancestors? So the book of Deuteronomy shows that this process of covenant renewal, 40 years after Sinai, 40 years after the law of the covenant was presented in that imperative, apodictic is the technical word, language, you shall not. It happens different in Deuteronomy. This time, it's preached. It's presented in the language of persuasion so that the people get to think through and appreciate the benefits of the covenant. You could say in very basic terms, it's sold to them. And I just wonder if Moses, after 40 years of banging his head against the stiff-necked people, learned a few things. That you're going to have to get these people to see and understand that this is good. This is not an oppressive arrangement that's been laid on them. So today's passage that Harmon read is representative of that preached law. See, I have set before you today life and good, death and evil. If you obey the commandments of the Lord your God that I command you today, by loving the Lord your God, by walking in his ways, and by keeping his commandments and his statutes and his rules, then you shall live and multiply, and the Lord your God will bless you in the land that you are entering to take possession of. Sounds good, doesn't it? But understand, if your heart turns away and you will not hear, but are drawn away to worship other gods and serve them, I declare to you today that you shall surely perish. You shall not live long in the land that you are going over the Jordan to enter and to possess. I call heaven and earth to witness against you this day that I have set before you life and death, blessing and curse. Therefore, people, choose life, that you and your offspring may live, loving the Lord your God, obeying his voice, and holding fast to him. For he is your life and length of days, that you may dwell in the land that the Lord swore to your fathers, to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob, to give them. You get the tone. It's a winsomeness here. But understand, wrong choice, bad outcomes. Good choice, good outcomes. But you need to do it together. So, choose the Lord, all goes well with you and your children and the land. But don't, and you shall not live long in the land. You'll get in there and then everything will fall apart. And guess what happens? You read the Old Testament and it's a saga where they choose well, and they choose not so well. So, solid, active, collective decision. And your choice is either blessing in life or curse in death. No sitting on the fence. And the weight that you carry, good people, is that the results of your collective decision will be borne by generations to come. Okay, so I've traced out the story today because it's so far from where we are today. So far. Our world today does not function out of any sort of wholehearted shared commitments of whole populations. It just doesn't work that way. Margaret Thatcher, okay, she's one voice among many, but she said it this way in the 1980s. Society, there's no such thing. And she proceeded to lead government on that basis. We're used to fragmentation. And what we do is, instead of actually being together, when I say we, this is the world we live in, we rely on politics and economics to sort of cobble something together. if we can get enough of a consensus here and a bit over here. The man in the White House at the moment wrote a book, or rather got someone to write it for him, The Art of the Deal. That says it all. Instead of a total yes, everything is negotiable, a bit here, a bit there. You get win-win and we'll move forward. So it doesn't come to us naturally, being a people, making decisions that everyone buys into. And it shows that the results are there. So we are a covenant people. We are in direct continuity with that first covenant. And in Jesus Christ, we are covenanted in baptism to him. But the living out of it is such a challenge. This is what I think happens. We have a door. And once you come in the door, physically, we start living as church. Because that's what we want to do. We want to be church. But very soon after that, the tensions between ourselves and others start to play out. What do I need to do? Thank you. Okay. So the tensions between ourselves as individuals, that me, myself, and I, and what it is to be a covenant people starts to play. Because that's the world we live in. That's how everything else works. I learned a long time in this church, a long time ago, to never expect one size to fit all. It just doesn't. I'll give you an example. 10:30. You know, as I've said before, what does that mean? But then occasionally something comes along that actually, people, you need to think together. You need actually to be solid in solidarity here. You need to speak with one voice. You need to have a yes or a no rather than a, well, there are various viewpoints on this and we can accommodate this and accommodate that and keep everyone happy. Those of you who lived in countries that fought World War II might remember this. Because if you're in a war, and it's total war, you're only going to win it if you're really all in it together. So the mindset's a few generations old, and it makes sense of older GI type people. So, in our world today, can you think of anything on the horizon that might require some more collective thinking? Global warming? What I've got on mind is a nasty flu virus. And, you know, I don't know if you're reading daily what's happening in relation to coronavirus or COVID-19. But you're right, global warming, it's so hard to get agreement unless 7 billion people really pull together. Can anything effective happen? I wanted to talk a little bit about coronavirus or effective being collective in the face of what could become an issue. Might not. All the work that's been done in China might have contained the virus, and it's not going to become a big issue outside. On the other hand, it could do what a lot of viruses have done in history and really spread. So I want to apply some of this kind of... what should I do, people, with this? Okay. I'm going to be upgraded. How are we doing? Is that better? Okay. Can I give you this one, Andrew? I'll just got tangled up here. Thank you. Good, we're back in business. So what I really want to do here is just get us thinking collectively about this little virus. Because if we all just take this on as stunning individuals, guess what? The virus is no respecter of that. It's an opportunist. So I had a couple of thoughts. The first, if an epidemic really broke out in this part of the world, we probably wouldn't meet at all. It's a public health issue, and been told people don't gather, right? Like in Wuhan. And we're being resourceful, we'd probably do something on the internet. But even without a full outbreak, it'd be good to learn together a few things we can do to enhance our corporate safety. So get away from thinking about yourself and think about us. So how might we make the flu virus less likely? Well, as I said, you change our collective behaviour. We give options for people to manage the risk as they see it. Now, this is the third virus of this nature in my ministry over 26 years. And what I've learned over time is that people assess risk differently. You need a collective response, but there is also a sense that some people are more concerned about it than others, and rightfully so. You know if you have high resistance or low resistance. You know those sorts of things. So it's good to have options. And thirdly, I think about children, those little spreaders of all sorts of bugs and germs. Okay, so in terms of our collective behaviour, I want to suggest something that actually is very biblical, but in a very modern package, and it's simple hand cleaning. Apparently our hands are where most of the bugs are, more than our mouth, apparently. When I was in Israel last year, one of the things I saw, every site I went to, were ritual bathing baths, mikveh, they're called, mikveh. And you read it in the Bible, washing to come to worship, washing to come to a sacred gathering was standard part of worship. It's good practice. So the request is that everyone really makes an effort to wash their hands with soap and water before they come to worship. And if you can't, and we've got it already in place today, there are going to be a couple of bottles there where you just hit the top and you get some hand cleaner. So, no pain. It's something everyone can do. And the advice is that it's significant. Soap and water or hand cleaner. Now, I'm not going to do Moses on the mountain here, but people, will you do it? You have to decide. Okay. Secondly, in support of us, those of us who are ministering communion, and today we'll be starting with us, we will wash our hands extra before we touch the bread or start ministering communion. So that's another easy gain. Skin contact. Apparently skin contact is a big part of this. The discipline is don't touch your own face. So own face may be sort of a tactile delight, but just keep your hands away from your face. That's so simple, but again, deemed significant. Now, we practice the peace. The peace is an interesting thing. In the Bible, it's called the holy kiss, but Anglo-Saxons have adapted it. And, we do it with some form of embrace or touch. I don't think things are really at a critical phase, but it may be sensible sometime to say, okay, given where things are, we'll drop that for the time being. Or a wave. Okay. A wave. Peace be with you. Demonstrate, please, Bala. Brilliant. Okay. We can do it. We'll go Indian. Peace. Holy kiss, Indian style. So, the third thing is, if you're going to cough or sneeze, it's so simple, use a handkerchief or a tissue. Apparently, this virus aerosols really well. It travels through the air. But if you use a handkerchief or a tissue, maybe your standard practice, you say, he's telling me the most basic things, but if we do it together, it's become significant. And lastly, I thought face masks. If you want to wear a face mask, okay. So feel free to do so. It's an option. Apparently, it's better at containing the virus than preventing it from reaching you. So those are just a few things. Hand cleansing, if we could all wash our hands some way before we join for worship. Avoid skin contact, that means your own, includes your own skin. Definitely use tissues or coughing, when coughing or sneezing. And allow those who wish to wear a face mask. Any questions? Do you think we can do that together? Okay. Then there are the ways we minister communion, because communion really is a shared meal. And meals are all about intimacy. This is not fast food. This is not, you know, food on the go, grab and run. This is meant to be a shared moment. So the first thing I think is, again, to give some, to relax any tensions that may be there. The church, since the Reformation, has taught that communion offered in one form represents communion. So if you only take the bread, that is communion. You have the option of taking the wine as well. But if, for example, you're sitting there thinking, I'm really anxious about the wine, you don't have to. You have that option. It's up to you. Secondly, if you're a dipper, an intincter, please, please, please keep your fingers out of the wine. So I'm advised that this needs to be said. So to help that, I'm going to try and break the bread in linear form. Instead of sort of, you know, little dots, that makes it sort of a precision exercise. So these are all little things that that easy gains, but we can change things. Any questions? So communion, those ministering will wash their hands. You can have one form or two. You can already choose between dipping and sharing a cup. Keep your fingers out, and we'll try and make it easy. So then come the children. Now, we have the practice of bringing children into the space. And it's in some ways it's a response to the diversity, because, again, some people, the sort of arrangements and the practices of admitting children to communion are so different. And we don't do a cookie cutter, one size fits all. So, but children, are part of this equation. So there are a few issues here, and some of them are more behavioural than hygiene. So to minimise physical contact, I always pray a blessing, or the priest on the day prays a blessing, and the practice is to mark a cross on the forehead. But that's skin on skin, isn't it? So what I'd like to move towards, especially when there's risk, is simply a hand of blessing. Okay, so that's, again, less skin contact. Because if you think about it, this hand touches every hand, every forehead. You know, I could be public health enemy number one. So, where parents could really help, and if you have children who come to communion, is explaining what's happening at communion. Now, this is not a microbe issue, but a understanding behaviour issue. I've noticed over the years a lot of children don't seem to know where they are or what to do. So what I really want to encourage parents is to explain to children what's happening out of your own faith tradition and how to conduct themselves. And just to sort of accent this, I would say at present about the half of small children, so that's children up to three, make a grab for the communion bread. That's the current rate of of what happens. And I don't know, maybe they haven't had breakfast. Maybe they are used to see food and eat it. But again, the request is, explain to them, in your own words, what is happening and what the right thing for them to do is. And, you know, my concern is partially to sort of the reverence and the respect of the situation. So, apart from hygiene concerns and the odd hand action there, yeah, that's what I have in mind for communion for children. So, let's touch more information and possible that their fingers sort of stay out of the communion plate. Sorry to have to say this, but that's the reality. It's just how it is. So, what we've done today, we went back to about 3,400 years ago, Moses on the plains of Moab, putting big decision before people. And I've used that as a springboard fast forward to today, where we're not used to big decisions, we're not used to corporate decisions, to say, well, sometimes something comes along, like coronavirus, and actually we need to act together. Some of you will be aware of all the politics raging around measles, inoculations and things like that. In some countries, those who say, well, no, I don't need it and my kids don't need it, well, they actually make everybody vulnerable. So that's happening around the world. It's that sort of situation. And I just really want to, you know, commend that we respond together. Washing hands, avoiding skin contact, good use of tissues, and helping the kids in, you know, this intimate environment. So maybe something like this gives an opportunity to upgrade our solidarity. A lot of people look back to World War II and remember, gosh, we were together. Yeah, there were horrible days, but we were together. We were in this together. And that's something that I wish for us in relation to this sort of challenge. It's not an issue now, but I thought to talk about it now because who knows, in 2, 3, 4 weeks, it might be an issue. If you have any thoughts about this, please, you know, let me know. I'm not an expert. I did biology until the fifth form, if that means something, about 15-year-old. So I'm not coming at this so much from the medical side, but I see the spiritual opportunity here. Let's see if we can do this. Amen? Amen.